From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
I want to say thank you. Thank you for making your voices heard. And let's come together and build a city that is truly for all of us.
We'll talk with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on his goals for the next 4 years. Also today, the Massachusetts High Court takes up the question, how much responsibility does a university bear when a student takes his own life?
Most of the students who are at risk at these schools are not easy cases like Han Wen's case was. He was well known to this school to be at risk of student suicide.
Plus, the story of Steve Ross, the man behind the New England Holocaust Memorial.
Stand up and be counted. And racism, bigotry, stand up. Don't let anyone get away with it. Speak out. Don't be quiet about it. I could tell you plenty of stories because racism is not new to me. I lived with it.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get started with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, fresh off his election victory on Tuesday night, and he joins us now. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Hey, congratulations on getting reelected. First things first, what are you going to be your, I guess, your first priority when you get reinaugurated in January?
I think our first priority started yesterday when I had a conversation with Sheila Dillon about housing. I'm not waiting for inauguration. We're going to hit the ground running, continue to look at the housing and continue to look at how we can create more housing in our city. I think during this campaign, there's a lot of criticism of the administration and not building enough housing, but we have built a lot of housing. We've built more housing than almost any other period in the history of our city, and we have to continue to do that to make sure that we can be a city for all.
Oh, so this is really interesting, Mayor Walsh, because, I mean, yes, absolutely. You've got the Boston 2030 plan, 55,000 new units of housing planned. But, I mean, what kind of things were you hearing specifically from constituents that, is there room for adjustments to that plan or new ideas?
No, well, absolutely. But, I mean, we've permitted 22,000 of those units in 3 years. And I think that, a lot of those housing, almost 9,500 of those units are moderate, low-income housing in the city. So we're going to continue to look at those areas, and we're going to look at the plan to see where we can make some adjustments on the plan. One of the things that we talk about in a housing plan or any plan that we have, the beauty about them is that they can change and they can be adjusted. And it's not something that we're stuck on where in the past you do a plan and you'd stick to it, meaning you'd be kind of stuck with that plan. Our plans are going to continue to change and evolve and adjust like they should.
Okay. Well, you won with 65% of the vote on Tuesday night. Do you feel like that gives you a mandate, that people have really thrown their support behind you?
I mean, I know people always talk about the mandates and things like that. I don't know if it's a mandate. I'm honored by the vote we received. I think that the fact I'm honored that, 65% of the people that went out and voted thought that I was doing a good job and that I should continue in this job. And we're going to continue to do it. We're going to continue to do the job that I've done for the last 4 years and try and build off of the accomplishments we've had. And I think that that's what's key here. I mean, I don't think that some people, I was reading the paper today, they're talking about taking bold positions on things and moving forward. I'm not sure what that means. I think that the biggest issues I heard about in the last 6 months of the campaign, and we knew about this, was housing,
yeah,
was economic development, was income inequality, which goes hand in hand with income, with economic development, the education, continuing to make improvements in our educational system. We've made some real good progress. We have more to do. And then in certain neighborhoods, crime was an issue. Not in all, but in certain neighborhoods, crime and public safety was a concern. So those are the main four issues we need to build off of. And those issues, quite honestly, the first three can take care of the fourth one. If people have a job and have opportunities and have an education, then there's less likely chance that they have to turn to crime in our city. And mm-hmm. I think that's important that, both short-term, it's about creating opportunities through job training programs, and long-term, it is by education and having kids graduate.
Yeah. Mr. Mayor, I heard you say that you read in the paper that people are talking about certain things and you're not sure what that means. And I will grant you, there's a perfectly legit argument to be made about, like, columnists write stuff, whatever. Who cares what a bunch of journalists think?
No, I don't.
No,
mean
but
that
what
way.
I wanted to say is, I mean, no, I didn't take any offense. I don't think anyone does. I just want to say, like, I want to acknowledge that, like, yeah, everyone, there's a lot of chattering folks out there. They are my colleagues. I respect them. But one thing which I was reading, for example, Adrian Walker saying a little bit and Shirley Leung saying a little bit is that, like, okay, you won re-election. You actually had 2/3 of the vote. That's a strong showing. Some folks are saying now it's time maybe to focus, and instead of trying to accomplish everything, you know, focus on 2 or 3 of the most important issues and see what kind of intense progress you can make.
You can't as mayor. You can't do that as mayor. As mayor, and actually the person that talked about Amanda, I think, was Larry DeCara, so he's not even a columnist. It was Larry DeCara in one of the articles, and Professor O'Brien from U.S. Boston were talking about mandates. But as mayor, you don't have the luxury of focusing on one issue or 3 or 4 issues. Maybe, you know, in the United States Senate in Congress, if the legislature could focus on 3 or 4 pieces of legislation to move our country forward, you could. But as mayor, you have so many different constituencies and so many different issues pop every day that you can't just focus on 1 or 2. So that means let's say I pick 3. Let's hypothetically say I pick public safety, education, and housing. That means that I'm leaving economic development off the table. That means I'm leaving basic city services off the table. That means that I'm leaving so many other issues that people, the environment, off the table. So you don't have that luxury as mayor. And I think that, you know, in the last 4 years, we've accomplished a lot across the board. That's why you have people that are working for you. That's why you have a cabinet and empower the cabinet. I was reading something last night. There was a synopsis of Kevin White's was talking about in 1999 at a campus about his term as mayor, and that, you know, he surrounded himself with young bright people and allowed them to do their job. And I think if you do that, you can accomplish a lot as an administration. But as a mayor, you can't focus on 2 things and say that's it.
Right. So I'm just curious. You lost 2 city wards to Councillor Tito Jackson, Ward 12 in Jamaica Plain and 11 in Roxbury. Was close in Ward 19, but just specifically regarding those folks, I mean, you very eloquently in your victory speech said you want to build a city that's truly for all of us. How would you particularly, what do you have to say to those folks in particular?
I mean, I think I continue to go out there. I mean, I think one of the wards was Councillor Jackson's ward. So expected him. He should have won that ward. I mean, he's been representing them since 2011. I think parts of 19, I mean, we have work to do out there, and I'm going to continue to be out in the streets. I have been. I've spent a lot of time in those neighborhoods. I'd argue that I spent more time in those neighborhoods than even Councillor Jackson over the last 4 years, and I'm going to continue to be out in those communities and building relationships up and building trust up. There's a lot of challenges. In Ward 19, housing is one of the issues. You know, housing in general, people don't want housing being built in the community in a lot of Ward 19. It's not even just building low-income housing. So we have challenges in some different neighborhoods as well. I mean, if we want to continue to build housing for the poor and for the working class, we need to find locations to build it. And some neighborhoods don't want it. So we have some work to do, opportunities for economic development, opportunities in different parts of the city as well. I mean, so I think what I do with these numbers now is I sit down, I haven't done it yet, I sit down and I look at the numbers in the city of Boston, and I look at the neighborhoods where I did well and look at the neighborhoods where I didn't do so well. I start to look at the issues that are concerning the folks in those neighborhoods, and we get to work on it.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, and for the people listening, you know, I won 20 out of 22 wards of the city. So when people think about this, it's, you know, just so they know, the campaign did win 20 out of 22 wards, and in the communities of color, we won those communities in this race as well.
Yeah, you know, I don't necessarily want to sort of rehash the campaign because we want to look forward. But there's one thing I do want to ask you about, something that Councillor Jackson did say repeatedly as he was campaigning before election night. You know, he talked about, you know, he told me several times that he thinks the mayoralship, the office of the mayor in the city of Boston, not you specifically, but the office itself, is too powerful, right? I mean, you heard him talk about how he wants to increase power at the city council, how he wants to have an elected school board, things like that, how he wanted to take apart what was once called the BRA. Do any of those ideas seem interesting to you?
No, they don't. I mean, first of all, the power of the mayor, I mean, basically what he was saying is that the city council doesn't have the ability to move as a legislative body forward, and that's not correct. And I think that, you know, when I was a state representative, a couple of times I was there, I was not in leadership, and I was able to accomplish by building relationships up. So it's about building relationships. He talks about dismantling the Boston Planning and Development Agency. We have states and cities from around the country coming to look at our model to say this model is incredible. We have the best economic growth, one of the most active economic growth in the history of our city, and here he wants to dismantle it. That doesn't make any sense. That's not the way to move forward. He talked about police overtime and putting more police on, reducing overtime. It's not that simple. And in his budget, quite honestly, he put a budget forth that actually cut money in education, that didn't increase money in education. And again, I think that some of this stuff is, when I think about it, you know, the reason why we went into the Boston Redevelopment Authority and we spent $600,000 was actually to make changes, and we've been recognized both by press editorial boards and by the public for the changes that we've made there, and we're going to continue to make sure there's a transparent process. On hiring, I heard the council criticize us on hiring, saying we're not transparent. Anybody can go to the cityofboston.gov website. I have a data dashboard that's real time of the diversity in the city. So I don't know how much more transparent we can get. So there's a lot of things we're going to continue to work off of.
Yeah.
But I think the council, in a lot of ways, I think he was, you know, grasping at straws in some cases.
Yeah. You know, look forward with me a little bit, because one of the I think kind of exciting but challenging aspects of this next term for you is that, as you were mentioning earlier, the city is undergoing tremendous growth. I mean, that there's a lot of opportunity there, but the challenge feels like, you know, how do Bostonians help direct that growth in the right way so that everyone benefits from it?
Well, I think I'm going to go back for you. We had a master planning process, Imagine Boston 2030, master planning the future of the city. We had over 11,000 Bostonians part of that conversation. We had a transportation conversation where over 6,000 Bostonians were part of the conversation. It's the first time in I can remember Bostonians being part of creating a vision for the city. We tackled chronic veterans homelessness, where we ended it last year. We've housed 1,200 chronically homeless people in the city of Boston in the first term. We're permitted 22,000 units of new housing. We've changed the inclusionary development, which is the affordable component, from 13 to 18% in the city, and we've been able to net $57 million in more money this year for affordable housing. We're able to pass the Community Preservation Act that in 2001 the city tried. They couldn't do it. They did it. We did it in 2016. So I think this campaign, I mean, unfortunately, my friend and my challenger was focusing on negative all day long and didn't talk about positive. And there's, you know, there was no acknowledgement that we did anything right. A lot of great things have happened. Now what we have to do moving forward is, how do we increase that? How do we increase that production of workforce affordable housing? How do we continue to double our efforts and continue to make great gains in our schools? How do we make sure that, you know, when we talk about the environment, that we truly are protected? How do we make sure that we truly have a strong bike infrastructure? All of that will come off of a good economy, but we also have to keep an eye on, if the economy goes down and we're faced with cuts at a federal level or state level, how do we handle that? So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot that we're preparing for. That's why when I say a day at a time, you take this at a day at a time, because I could have all the fancy plans in the world, and if the economy goes down, that could seriously change the way we make investments for a little bit.
Well, one day at a time together, right?
Yes, no, absolutely.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Look forward to continuing the conversation.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Should a college be held responsible for a student's suicide? That's the question before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court this week in the case of Han Nguyen, an MIT grad student who killed himself in 2009. Nguyen, a 25-year-old PhD student, had met with psychiatrists at MIT's mental health clinic. He'd also reported a history of depression and suicide attempts in college. Faculty members had also expressed some concern about him. Jeffrey Beeler, the family's attorney, says that because MIT was aware of Nguyen's serious struggles with mental health, the university had a duty to do more to prevent his suicide.
That was their role. They said they were going to do that. They said, we're going to stay in touch and connection with the student. 2007, they had him, and they dropped him.
Attorney Kevin Martin, representing MIT, says that Nguyen had chosen to pursue treatment outside of MIT, and universities do not have a duty to protect students from self-inflicted harm.
Society does not expect, for example, a landlord to protect a tenant from committing suicide in their own apartment building.
That's sound from oral argument this week before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Well, joining me now with some analysis is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
This is a complex and interesting case. I mean, what's your first thought about this big question? Should universities be responsible?
Well, I think the answer is it depends, and as it always does. I mean, so there's never a duty to prevent a suicide. If someone is, you know, just in general walking down the street, you don't have a duty. There are certain special relationships. Somebody in prison, when the prison authorities know about them being suicidal. A university is in a different kind of situation. The university has a duty to protect, you know, to make sure that no one breaks down the door of the dorm. And I suppose on the other end, if the university actually knew that this young man was suicidal and he sought services there, there could be obligations that adhere to the university. But that's the factual question here, whether they knew when he sought outside help.
Well, so to that point, I just want to play another bit of tape from the family's lawyer, Jeffrey Beeler. And Beeler told the SJC that he argued that the university does have a, quote, duty of reasonable care, even if a student does not have an imminent risk of suicide. Here's what Beeler said.
If you say to the schools, you don't need to use reasonable care except during what would be an imminent suicide crisis, a kid standing on the side of the building saying, I'm going to throw off or jump off. What you do is you miss the opportunities that these schools have to intercede earlier in the process, which is when you can save these students.
Judge Gertner, react to that.
That's an extraordinary thing to say. That would essentially require schools to be proactive with students, and in particular, this is a 25-year-old student. It would require, one policy argument is that it would require intervention. It would have implications for privacy of students. It would require them to stand in the shoes of a intervening parent in the ways that we usually don't require them to do. It's one thing to say, you got to make sure that the locks are working on the doors and, you know, that the premises are safe. But now you're talking about intervening in what is a very difficult situation. It seems to me that's a different issue.
Does it matter that he was 25 and a grad student and not an undergrad?
It matters. It matters. I think, you know, no one has ever set up this duty of a college to intervene in this way. And if they're going to do that, it's not likely to be with respect to a graduate student at that age. It's likely to be, if it occurs at all, at younger ages in a different kind of setting.
Like below 21?
Yes, that's right. That's right. But even with respect to that, the university doesn't stand in the same shoes as, you know, the prison guard vis-a-vis the prisoner, where basically you have all obligation to watch that person all the time. This would be an obligation to intervene, which is very unusual, and we so far haven't put on colleges and universities.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, we're seeing that advisors at MIT had recommended that Nguyen pass classes regardless of his performance. He was sent to meet with MIT Mental Health Services in 2007 and that he had continually sought psychiatric treatment, not just at MIT, but 9 hospitals as well, MGH, McLean, throughout his time at MIT. And then in addition to that, we have some more tape from MIT's lawyer, Kevin Martin. You know, given the backdrop of the number of hospitals that Nguyen had visited for treatment, Kevin Martin, again representing MIT, claims that the student wanted to keep his mental health treatment and his academic lives separate.
Students these days quite reasonably expect that the decisions they make about their own medical treatment, including mental health treatment, will be respected by their universities.
I mean, again, this sort of gets to that line of like a question of where do we draw the line? He was seeking treatment outside of MIT, so how much should MIT be responsible for knowing about that?
That's what I'm saying. There's never been an affirmative duty for a college to make sure that everyone is, you know, fine and not suicidal who are within the walls of the college. There may well be a duty if they expressly knew about a particular kid with suicidal ideation where they think it's going to be imminent. So where this fits between the one hand, where there's no obligation in the general case, and on the other, where you know about a particular threat to a particular kid, is another issue. This sounds like the what happened in the court below is the court dismissed the case, and I would bet that the SJC is going to affirm that.
Mm. Well, but let me ask you, I mean, universities have been taking greater responsibility for student safety when it comes to potential threats from third parties,
right,
for example.
But safety is a different issue because a student
safety
can't,
from self-harm?
Well, a student can't affect that safety herself, right? You can't fix the locks and make sure there are guards and video. But with a particularly a 25-year-old student, they can take steps to seek out help. In other words, it's not the same thing as locks and doors and guards as with respect to complex mental health issues. That's why if something comes out of this at all, it would be an obligation, it seems to me, to intervene when you know specifically that intervention is appropriate. Otherwise, you're talking about a duty with respect to, you know, everyone, which would be very difficult and very taxing to a university.
So that's why this case is so interesting, though, because Nguyen's family and lawyers arguing that MIT did know. I mean, that faculty members were so concerned about his mental health that they were saying you should just pass him in his classes so
right,
as to not, you know, further his mental anguish.
Well, but being concerned about mental health is not the same thing as being concerned that someone's going to throw themselves off a roof. Being concerned about mental health may well be, you know, qualify every student in graduate school at MIT. But the question is whether they knew enough to believe that suicide was imminent. Again, bearing in mind that the decision to take one's own life is a complicated decision, that we ordinarily don't hold people responsible for someone else's decision to do that, except under very narrow circumstances.
You know, in briefs to the court, 18 Massachusetts universities have written that a professor checking in on a student's mental health status, they argue, could actually prevent students from reporting health or mental health concerns. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I think that I read that as well. I mean, that could be, that's certainly a student that could basically then not tell people about it. But it also creates affirmative obligations for colleges and universities, which has implications for privacy, resources, all sorts of things, which we have not, I mean, it's creating, you know, the concept was parents patriae, the notion of standing in the shoes of the parents. This would be a much more aggressive standing in the shoes of a parent than we've ever seen before. That's why I think this is very different and not likely to succeed.
Well, Judge Gertner, while I've got you, can I ask you some questions in a couple more other areas
sure,
of the law? Let's turn to...
Ask me anything.
What's your favorite color? I know what your favorite color is. It's red. But you have actually recently written a piece in The Globe on the state's criminal justice reform bill. The Massachusetts House plans to start a debate on that very soon. And you've talked a lot about compassionate release for inmates. And the House bill has a provision for a compassionate release. What do you think?
Well, I represented Sal DeMacy, who used the federal compassionate release mechanism to be able to apply to the Bureau of Prisons to say that because he had two cancers and could not swallow, he could not function in a prison environment, losing weight, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, Bureau of Prison recommended that he be released, and he was released. There was, up until this bill, there was no provision for a dying prisoner to, in the state system, to apply for compassionate release. We simply had no mechanism. We're one of the few states without any mechanism to do so. And what that means is that we wind up spending, aside from the humanity of it, we wind up spending a huge amount of money on people who are on dialysis 24/7, who can't walk, who are amputees and have posed no threat to society and clearly just want to live out their lives out on the outside. We have no mechanism. There's a difference between the House bill, which has a much better mechanism for compassionate release, than the Senate bill. But we have to do something. It can't be a political decision. It needs to be a medical decision. And it has to be a medical decision, not just you are at death's door, you're going to leave, you know, we're going to let you out because you're going to die any minute. But it has to be where the medical situation so impairs this person's ability to function in prison that we're essentially talking about torture. You're talking about cruel and unusual punishment at a certain level.
Oh, that's strong. You're putting out some strong language there, because I think people would would disagree with you. There are still very many people who believe that if you are given a sentence by a jury of your peers or a judge, that that is the sentence you must serve out.
I appreciate those arguments. There's a certain point at which, though, you know, medical conditions that no one could have anticipated so undermine your ability to function in prison, when there's no public safety issue, when it does not make sense for this person to continue within the four walls, and especially when, as I said, many other states who are far less, quote, progressive than Massachusetts, have such provisions. And most industrial countries have a provision. The notion here is you get sentenced with one set of facts, what you did and who you are at that moment. And then facts can develop that affect your medical situation, which if a court maybe had known about at the beginning, could have affected your sentence.
So more broadly about criminal justice reform in Massachusetts, the Senate did pass its own version of the bill, and 9 Massachusetts DAs came out against the Senate version of the bill, saying that it would turn the clock back on important measures put into place by the legislature establishing victims' rights. And I think that, again, this is an argument that has it falls on a lot of sympathetic ears, because this is always the question when considering criminal justice reform. What about the victims?
Right. The premise of the DA's letter was all off. The notion that eliminating mandatory minimums would somehow improve public safety and help the victims is simply a false premise.
Or preserving mandatory minimums.
Right. This is completely a false premise. What we have seen is that the states that have in fact effected criminal justice reform, eliminated mandatory minimum sentencing, have seen their crime rates decline. It's simply not, there is no correlation between a mandatory sentence and the crime rate. And people need to know that, and the victims need to know that. I mean, in addition, the other side of the mandatory minimum, which I've written about, is Massachusetts may have a relatively low rate of incarceration, but we have one of the most disproportionate sentencing of African Americans and Hispanics in the country. And so the locus of that discrimination has to be from district attorneys who are making charging decisions about who gets the mandatory minimum and who doesn't. And because it's not the judge, right? Once they charge, the judge is not making those distinctions. So if only to eliminate an egregious disparity, we have to eliminate mandatory minimums.
Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Judge Gertner. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bose is moving into Boston. The audio technology company has announced that it's moving part of its workforce from Framingham to Boston Landing in Brighton. A spokeswoman says it is a desirable location and easy to access by public transportation and the highway. Now, Bose is just the latest suburban company to open up offices in the city. There's a long list: Reebok, PTC, Autodesk, Converse, LogMeIn, and of course GE, which left Connecticut and moved to Boston Seaport for its world headquarters. So, is this a trend? Joining me now to discuss is Asma Khalid. She leads WBUR's business and technology team, Bostonomics. Hello, Asma.
Hi, Magna. I love that you say, is it a trend? Doesn't it usually take 3? I feel like there's quite a few more.
Oh, you're right. I was like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So yes, it is a trend. Bill Littlefield says like 2 is a trend. So 7. Okay, what's driving this trend then?
So Meghna, I would say there's kind of 3 main factors. One is talent, and you hear this from pretty much every company that I spoke to talks about the talent workforce that they're able to access being closer to Boston and Cambridge, specifically because of the educational institutions. The second is the accessibility to public transportation. Yeah. And the third is just there's a sort of focus on a new workplace culture of collaboration, and that tech nowadays looks very different than tech 20 years ago, and there's a lot more open source, a lot more collaboration, a lot more sort of meetups between companies. And I spoke specifically to this recruiting firm called Winter Wyman about this trend. They've been helping companies find workers for decades. Mm-hmm. And Ben Hicks is this guy who handles the company's tech search division. He told me that they actually just closed out their fiscal year in September. And when they did that, they looked at all the data based on geography.
I see.
And for this past year, for the companies that they were hiring for, 40% of the jobs were in downtown Boston. Another 20+% were in Cambridge, essentially Kendall Square.
Wow.
I mean, that means you're talking about, right, over 60% of the tech jobs are in this Boston-Cambridge area. And he told me as a comparison, he was with the company 20 years ago. And back then, maybe like 5% of tech jobs were in the urban core of Boston.
A huge shift then. Okay.
A huge, huge shift. And, you know, if we compare that, right, to many years ago, I think that really the focus on tech jobs used to be along Route 128. And he told me that this is a steady trend that he's been seeing for a number of years. And a lot of it is, as I described, it's about the talent workforce and the fact that a lot of 20s and 30 millennial folks live in this area. They don't necessarily have access to a car, nor do they want to work out in like Woburn or Framingham.
Okay. Let me just ask you more about talent, though, because I suppose millennials, I'm not going to speak about them as a monolithic group because they're not. They're definitely not. But, I mean, how long does the attraction of the urban core last is another way of me asking.
How long?
Who knows, right?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. I think that, you know, Winter Wyman's folks told me that they saw this trend. They sort of started to notice it, I think he said, about 10 years ago. It's been a steady increase. And he doesn't see the pendulum shifting back to the suburbs for now, at least, because it's really been a sort of lifestyle change. And I would say that this is something I consistently heard from the companies that I spoke with, that really talent is centered around Boston and Cambridge. And, you know, this isn't necessarily a factor for your senior executives, but it is when you're looking at your sort of mid-level managers, certainly your entry-level employees. I heard this from someone at LogMeIn, told me that this was a huge factor. And then I spoke also with Eric Snow. He's the senior vice president of corporate marketing at PTC. It's a software company. And they're moving from Needham to the Seaport. In fact, they're in the process of constructing that office now. And he said that as a company, they wanted to be closer to where the innovation is happening. And he sees that as Boston.
We are in a very competitive marketplace in the software industry and technology generally. And we believe that being in an urban location will assist with both attracting new employees that we're looking for, as well as giving existing employees a reason to stick around.
Okay. So talked about talent and where maybe the talent wants to be. Dive a little bit more into some of the other things that you mentioned about why companies see moving into the city
sort
as a benefit.
Of culture, right, and collaboration. So I spoke with someone at Reebok, and Reebok, you know, has this, it's sort of in the past now, had this massive 60-plus acre campus in Canton. It was complete with soccer fields and whatnot, right? It was this really sort of traditional suburban campus. And this fall, they also moved to Boston. And I spoke with Matt O'Toole about this shift. He's the president of Reebok brand. And he described this sort of cultural shift in general that companies are making. I should say, Megan, I spoke with him when he was in a security line at the Munich airport. So this phone quality is not awesome. But let's hear what he had to say.
Companies are realizing how interconnected they are to other businesses and the need to be, I think, much more collaborative. And I think it's difficult to do that in a more cloistered environment.
And Megna, he candidly pointed out that, look, he said, you know, our competitors are here. New Balance, Converse, and you feed off of each other. And this is something I heard from a number of other tech companies, right? This idea that you really want to be where other companies are. I spoke with Dina Upton. She's the director of people and talent at LogMeIn. LogMeIn, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're a software company as well. They essentially kind of give you remote secure access, right, to your computer and other devices. And they are one of these companies that actually moved to Boston a few years ago. So a bit, you could say, kind of on the early...
A little ahead of the curve.
2013. Yeah. And she said that a big part of this is the fact that you're around these other companies. It allows you to sort of be this hub for meetups. It allows you to be tapping into sort of the ecosystem, right? When there's after work meetups, when there's coding sessions, everything like that. And she says maybe also LogMeIn can be this kind of hub so that employees who might be interested would come to the company and figure out what to do, and maybe they would be interested in the company. They used to be based out in Woburn, and she says that would just never happen, you know, right? You had to drive to get to Woburn. And then what I love, Magna, she gave me really all these incredibly intellectual reasons for moving. But then she also says that city living is just really a better lifestyle, and she specifically spoke about the food and dining options. She said Woburn just didn't have that.
It was an office park, yep. So I mean, basically, like, if you wanted to go anywhere to lunch, you had to get in your car, drive underneath the highway to get to a couple of restaurants. And so you're constantly, you know, you're not going miles, but you're at least, you can't walk underneath the overpass to get to a decent restaurant. Where here, there's tons of places to just walk out.
Okay, I have some strong reactions to that. I mean,
she gave me a lot of other reasons.
I'm sympathetic,
just loved this.
But, like, Woburn has good restaurants. Shout out to Woburn. But to her larger point, and really, I wanted to ask you about this. I get it. Like, there's a lot of pluses to urban living, but particularly in Greater Boston right now. I mean, like, some of the minuses are you can't have a yard, right? Like, you can't afford more than one bedroom.
It is. It's expensive.
Whereas you can do that in the suburbs. That quality of life is still available.
No, that is valid. And I think that even when you're talking about companies, right, cost is a major challenge. And so we've seen some of these larger companies make the move. But you don't see this necessarily with software companies. I mean, right, Ben Hicks, who I mentioned earlier, he leads that software tech search division for the recruiting firm Winter Wyman. He says that, you know, even though a good 60%+ of jobs that they are hiring for are between Boston and Cambridge, that actually back in 2015, it was closer to 70%. Mm-hmm. And he says that, you know, maybe what they're starting to see could be a bit of a leveling off. And he says that could be because of rents.
Affordable real estate in the city, because of the movement into the city over the last 5 years, has become harder to come by and more expensive. Because so much of the tech hiring is small companies and startups, they have a very defined budget, right? They can't go out and have the most expensive or the fanciest office space. So I think that's where we've seen it level out a little bit.
And, you know, Megan, mm-hmm. he is really cautious. He doesn't want to say that we're seeing this pendulum shift back by any means. But it is this sense that for some companies, it's very circular, right? The more companies move to Boston, the more expensive rent becomes, the more sort of inaccessible it
it's
becomes.
It's a feedback loop.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Totally.
Absolutely. I'm curious, though. I mean, speaking of that feedback loop, I mean, this all sounds really great for Boston, Cambridge, you know, for the urban core. But if you're one of those suburbs that used mm-hmm. to be the home to all of these workers and employees, like, it's got to be kind of a tough time to lose all of that.
I would imagine it is very worrisome, right?
Yeah.
And I would say candidly, Megna, I haven't spoken, right, to folks out, say, in Woburn or Framingham, even Andover. But you've got to think that the idea of sort of basing your economy off of a traditional sort of suburban office park is just not necessarily a winning strategy. You have to sort of diversify out your economy. I think what we might see, and I'll be curious to see how this plays out, are sort of those mid-level suburbs, right? Like,
right.
If you think about TripAdvisor, a couple of years ago, they decided to build out their main office headquarters in Needham, right? So it's a sort of middle, like, mid-level place, right? It's not this idea of going way out there, but it's also not really here in the sort of urban core of Boston. And what I think is interesting is my understanding is the company thought, okay, well, this is accessible to our suburban employees, and they were running shuttles then from Cambridge mm-hmm. for their sort of mm-hmm. urban core millennials who may want to live here can also get out to that campus.
Helping them get out to work. Okay, so maybe that's a glimpse of how some of the suburbs may be dealing with this transition. But to get back to Boston, I mean, how is this trend going to affect Boston's future, you think?
Well, I mean, Meghna, you know as well as I do that in the recent elections, we found out that, really affordable housing was probably
It'll
the
make
most
more
important
yeah.
issue. And I do think as we see more and more companies moving here, it will, right? Because they have to house their employees somewhere. I mentioned to you PTC, right? PTC is building up this massive complex in the seaport. They're anticipating that they're going to have, I think, around 1,000 employees here. I mean, say GE moved in a number of employees, Amazon. As more and more of these companies move to the urban core, certainly their employees are going to be receiving salaries that make this affordable housing really different. We're talking about affordability than, say, somebody who's working perhaps more of a service job.
Yeah. And we managed to get through that entire conversation without talking about what happens if Amazon actually does land its HQ2 here. Well, Asma Khalid, the head of WBUR's Bostonomics team, talking to us about this trend of companies formerly headquartered or located in and around Route 128 moving into the urban core. Really fascinating, Asma. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Steve Ross was just 9 years old when he was first imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. And over the next 5 years, he was starved, beaten, experimented on, forced into labor, and terrorized at 10 different death camps.
One time, I stole a potato. A guard saw me. He came over, he pulled me by the ear away, and he gave me 25 lashes with a lead pipe. And they broke my back. Today, I can't walk too well.
On April 29th, 1945, American soldiers liberated Dachau. Some 30,000 Holocaust survivors were freed, and Steve Ross was among them. And as he walked away from the camp, he came upon a U.S. Army lieutenant sitting on a tank and eating food. And what happened next transformed Steve Ross's life.
After I was rescued from hell in the Valley of Death, I came upon a soldier on a tank that showed me compassion for the first time, concern, and took me back to God, to civilization and mankind. He gave me his food. He put his arm around me, and he gave me a flag.
Well, this story is told in a new documentary called Etched in Glass, The Legacy of Steve Ross. It premieres at the Coolidge Corner Theater tomorrow night. And Roger Lyons, director of the film, joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
What an incredible story. Can you first tell us how you first came to know Steve and his story?
Sure. I was assigned to do one-minute profiles of unsung heroes in the community way back in 2000. And somebody suggested I call Steve Ross and maybe do a profile of him. And so I did. I called him up, and after a two-hour phone conversation with basically no pause in it, I thought, wow, what a great story. So I went down to the memorial, interviewed him, and just having seen the passion come out of him and all this just compelling story made me think that somehow somebody needed to do a longer piece than 45 seconds or a minute. And so I basically self-funded a bunch of shoots and followed him around and saw him in action speaking to kids in Boston High School and other places and just really inspiring them.
I mean, first, it just astonishes me that you had to try and fit his story into a 45-second piece. I mean, impossible because it's so profound, right? I mean,
right.
Tell us more about Steve's experiences in the death camps. I mean, being in prison when he was first just 9 years old.
Well, his parents actually tried to avoid that by sending him off with some farmers in Krasnik, who ultimately had to send him to the woods because the Nazis were going to kill anybody harboring Jews. So young Steve at 9 years old was in the woods with the partisans all by himself, basically, and the Nazis found him, saw that he was circumcised, said, "You're a Jew," and then encamped him for 5 years. So it was just a horrible situation. Everything you've seen on Schindler's List basically happened to Steve multiple times. And yet he endured, and he really, his will to live and his will to tell people what really happened was what kept him going.
Well,
I don't ever like using sort of film analogies here, but the Schindler's List one is appropriate because I mean in the documentary we learn that Steve had to hide in the feces of an outhouse as Nazi soldiers were murdering children, that he once grabbed onto the axle of a train to escape a camp, only to end up in another camp, obviously beaten and starved repeatedly. The cumulative effect of that, I still cannot imagine, but I just want to play a little bit more of tape from the documentary here of one of the effects that Stephen himself describes that all this had on him.
We began to realize that we are no longer human beings. We just were zombies living in a world that will not aid us.
Roger, talk to me more about this, because while Steve describes that, you know, he almost had to make himself into a kind of a zombie, here clearly is a man who never lost his humanity. Never, never.
Right. And he never gave up. He really wanted to live to tell the world what had happened. And so what he did ultimately, there were years where he just got beaten down and there was really not much he could do. But he basically started to act on trying to get out of there, which is why he literally ran under and grabbed the underneath of a train and got out of Auschwitz just after being tattooed with numbers on his arms. And he escaped. Again, yes, to find another death camp, but from every place he went, he tried to get out. And that was a difference between him and a lot of other folks who were encamped in there.
And he survived those attempts. I mean, like he survived what I'm sure was a retribution in trying to get out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, in the introduction to our conversation, we played a clip from the film. Again, the film is called Etched in Glass, where Steve describes the amazing experience he had upon his liberation from Dachau, encountering that U.S. soldier. Two quick things I want to ask you about that. First of all, my guess is that it would have been his first encounter with an Allied soldier, right? Like that,
right.
Every other soldier he'd met before that was probably a Nazi, right?
Right, they absolutely were. That's correct.
And that flag. Now, Steve's son is Mike Ross.
Correct.
He's the former Boston City Councilor. Just wanted to note that for folks who might have been wondering. But in terms of the flag that the soldier gave to Steve Ross, he still has that?
Yes. Well, he was given food. The soldier jumped off a tank, gave him some food and a hug, you know, an act of kindness.
Yeah.
And gave him this cloth to wipe the dirt off his face and tears and everything. And Steve, being a Polish kid, had no idea what this was. But he kept it as a memento. And he realized later on that it was an American flag. And at that point, he was driven to go to America and find that soldier to thank him for helping him out and showing him that act of kindness.
Did he find the soldier?
Well, you'd have to see the film.
Okay.
Because it comes a long way. He actually searched for the soldier for 67 years. And he was just driven to find this person.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. We're not going to ask you to give everything away. But tell us the story, though, of how Steve came to Boston.
Steve came over from the DP camps in Germany, originally to New York, and then came to Boston and lived in an orphanage in Dorchester. And he met some other folks. It really was sort of a place for wayward Jewish orphans of the war to be. And he met Bob Berger and some other folks that he became very friendly with. And he ended up remembering that his mother told him in order to be a great man, he really needed to get an education. And so his goal was to get educated, and he worked his way through three colleges, even though he started off speaking no English. Three college degrees, became a licensed psychologist in the city of Boston, became a street worker with Mayor Ray Flynn, former Mayor Ray Flynn, and helped young kids stay out of trouble.
Yeah. Now, the film is called Etched in Glass because Steve Ross is the major force, one of the major forces in the creation of the New England Holocaust Memorial.
That's correct.
Yeah. I mean, remind us what he did to make that happen.
It was his idea to do this, to build some kind of memorial to those who were fallen and killed and whatever back in the war. But he wanted to put something together where people could gather and pray for their ancestors, pray for the Jewish people, just a place, a physical place to go. And so he got together as it turns out, having already worked with Ray Flynn as a street worker, now Ray Flynn was the mayor and he worked with Ray to get that parcel of land that's on the Freedom Trail. And then he went after a huge fundraising campaign with Bill Carman of Newton and some others to raise enough money to build a huge monument to the people who were fallen.
Yeah. We just got a minute to go here, Roger. I wonder, the Holocaust Memorial has been vandalized twice recently in the past several months. I just wonder what Steve feels about sort of where we find ourselves as a nation today, you know, with the rise of the extreme right wing, a resurgence in anti-Semitic rhetoric and actions. I mean, it pains me. It's got to, I can't even imagine how he feels about this.
Right. Well, the first shoot I did with him after my little interview was at a Stop the Hate event at Boston High School. He's been on a campaign, anti-hate campaign, since he was born, really, but from the camps. That's been his thing. And so this kind of vandalism that really destroys something that's supposed to be a monument, a positive thing, is really something that he's been working his whole life against.
Yeah. Well, the film is called Etched in Glass, The Legacy of Steve Ross. It premieres at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline tomorrow night. So tomorrow at noon, thank you. We have more information about that at radioboston.org. Roger Lyons, director of the film, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.